This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Okay, so people can go research this on their own.
Salahuddin Ayyubi, the conqueror of Jerusalem, also known as Saladin.
So I'm actually a human rights professor who starts almost all my human rights courses depicting images and stories of the Holocaust.
Jews also, who are praising you for the work you're doing, speaking out against the injustices.
And we speak about the injustice of the Holocaust and injustices such as anti-Semitism as no different as injustices of Islamophobia encountered here in America. For centuries under Islamic rule, Jerusalem was a place of freedom, a freedom of worship.
Going to Jerusalem, and next thing you know, you guys are in a dungeon somewhere.
Absolutely. So,
and they also helped to preserve peace in the Middle East for many years.
We know there are many benefits to the use of black seed. That's why I used the black seed by Tasneem. And 50% of the profits from your order will go towards establishing the Deen Center, the Masjid and Mega Dawah Center. Use promo code The Deen Show for 15% off. Before I get into the future, current day, I'm going to just remind you that there was a point in time in history where Christian, Jewish, Muslim, under Muslim rule, you can go to Jerusalem and not have to get worried about taking a trip and then getting thrown into a dungeon and having your property taken away unjustly. Like what we're going to be talking about here, just incredible. This is mind-blowing. You have a professor of human rights and his research assistant. They're here on the Deen Show to relay them visiting this city. What city am I talking about? When ruled by Muslims. You had justice established, you had the three religions living there in a relative peace, and you didn't have things like this, what we're going to be talking about, happening with my next two guests here on The Deen Show.
Life of a traveler, experiences from different lands.
Our religion of Islam, with a brother. We love all the prophets.
The first command was called to the way of your Lord with wisdom.
Giving us stories that inspire.
In India.
That's motivation when you're feeling low. Speak your heart and let the world know. Bro, this is the Deen Show. Discussions on what's really real. Look at our law hills. Seeing transitions from another life. Like, look at our law guides. From the streets to Islam, reformed, letting old habits go. Inspiration from around the globe. Bro, this is the Deen Show.
Professor Hassan and Khalid is a research assistant. How are you?
Assalamu alaikum. A pleasure to be here, dear brother.
Thank you for having the time coming on to share your story. Now, I opened it up talking about, is this true? There was a time in history when you can go to Jerusalem, be it the Christian, Jew, and you didn't have all this chaos that's happening, all the oppression. Is this confirmed history?
Absolutely. For centuries under Islamic rule, Jerusalem was a place of freedom, a freedom of worship, Jews, Christians, Muslims living side by side. And now the experience is quite different. Just going to the Al-Aqsa Masjid is a huge hardship, truly a different world.
Okay, so people can go research this on their own.
Salahuddin Ayyubi, the conqueror of Jerusalem, also known as Saladin. He is best known for his role in the Third Crusade, when he led the Muslim forces to victory over the Crusaders and recaptured Jerusalem in 1187. And they also helped to preserve peace in the Middle East for many years.
That's not going to be really what we're going to be talking about, but I open that up because now it's one thing us talking about people getting detained, imprisoned, oppressed, and tortured, but you guys are two living, live examples. Got a Canadian citizen, American citizen, going to Jerusalem, and next thing you know, you guys are in a dungeon somewhere.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we were...
Can we describe it as a dungeon?
Absolutely. That's an exact description in one word of the experience that we endured. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, I mean, were you guys doing something illegal? I mean, why are you guys in a dungeon?
So we were conducting research on the occupation. We were embedded with youth activists that we encountered at Al-Aqsa Masjid. I was there for the year, my research assistant by my side. And the thing that we did that was of great concern to Israeli forces was that we called out for the liberation of Palestine. We put it on video. We were organizing youth to engage in peaceful protest to undo the occupation.
You said peaceful, not violent.
Absolutely. Pure, peaceful, following the tradition of those who spoke out at Tahrir Square in 2011, who came out en masse and spent days protesting the autocracy in Egypt.
What was there? There was something similar. It was at the fence, at the border. This was years ago. And you had doctors, you had people in wheelchairs, you had, I mean, just everyone coming out. What was that called? It was called, there was another name. It was a protest that happened by the border, by the fence. And then they were getting
being sniped and being attacked. And they were speaking out.
This was very peaceful, peaceful protest.
And many people were killed. Many of the officers at the border killed and maimed.
Do you remember the name of it?
I don't recall the name of the protest. But yeah, and it was very, very well covered in Gaza, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And many, many protests, just like that protest, have been completely stifled and squelched by authorities. One of the things they're extremely worried about is their media image, for the world to recognize the ways in which they treat Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of the more fundamental priorities of security forces to make sure that Palestinians are not treated with sympathy in global media.
Was that your first time there visiting?
It was my second time visiting. It was Brother Khaled's first time.
It was my first time visiting.
So how was day-to-day life when you get there? As soon as you get there, what's the feeling on the ground, the experience that you had just before you get thrown in the dungeon? What was it like?
Well, actually, it was, to me, it was an incredible experience. There's obviously the first moments where you come in and you're just, you know, the star-filled glory of Jerusalem. You know, it just is such a comforting experience praying in Al-Aqsa and feeling that peaceful moment after praying two rak'ahs. Is just priceless. And even though you begin afterwards to start to see the frightful torture of a people who are just trying to live, but their dreams are being squashed day after day. And so you see the forces, the checkpoints, just trying to go to Jerusalem. We were in a car with one of our friends, and they just stopped the car, and they didn't like how we looked, I guess. They just ripped me out from the back seat and started beating me up. And that's definitely not an experience I've had.
Hold on. So repeat that. This is like some people didn't get it. I mean, hold on. Why would someone, okay, you're driving, minding your own business.
Yes.
You weren't breaking any laws, were you?
Absolutely not.
Were you speeding? Even if you
were
speeding?
No. Actually, we were in traffic. So we're just all in.
So is this just random?
Well, I mean, it's presented as though it might be random, but obviously it's not. There's constant ethnic profiling of Arabs and Palestinians, and you know we're dressed in ways that are easily identifiable as Muslims, and so this particular woman who is
part, was a woman,
yeah, who she identified us, asked us to questions, and then she called Israeli forces to come to the site. So she didn't do it herself. Then the men came, they spotted us, and they ripped me out of the back seat where I was seated, and behind or between two cars in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. They beat me, pushed me down to the ground in a humiliating fashion, and completely searched the car inside out, afterwards releasing us back into the car. Nothing, no charges, and we were back in the car within some 20 minutes. And you and Amran were just waiting as they were beating me between the cars. Yeah,
they also got me out of the car as well, and they bashed me towards another car, and I raised my hand like this and I stayed until they got done with Dr. Hassan.
Mm-hmm.
Was a little treat.
Wow.
By them.
And these things happen a great deal, like even in Al-Aqsa, we on one of those days, like the where there are occupiers who enter the enclave of the masjid. I was beaten as we were protesting with other Palestinians within the masjid, because constantly there are occupiers who enter the masjid, sometimes on a daily basis, and huge numbers on Jewish
while
holidays.
While this is happening, what are you doing? What are you saying? What do you do?
What we do is we just congregate together as the forces escort these occupiers through the Al-Aqsa Masjid, and we declare and praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We also might shout, leave, this is not your land, or this is not your mosque.
When they pull you out of the car and now they're beating you, what are you saying? Like, you have no idea why they're doing this. What do you do? What are you saying? What are you?
What's going through your head? I'm praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You're praying to God,
and I'm asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for support. I'm also questioning them. I'm telling them that this is truly unjust. What you're doing here is exactly why this occupation is completely unjust. And I tried to engage in a conversation with the police. They brought one guy who speaks Arabic.
Yeah.
And he said, "Ikhras," like, shut up. They just couldn't tolerate hearing me repeatedly point out, what are we doing? This is completely unjust.
You're pretty much yelling injustice.
Exactly. And you could see that it's aggravating. The human being, for some reason, our conscience still is gnawing at us, that even the biggest oppressors can't withstand hearing from someone who clearly is being oppressed the word that they are the oppressor.
Yeah.
So this was also an extraordinary finding for us in our research, that speaking out doesn't just help other people to sort of garner sympathy for those who are oppressed. It's also for the oppressor to know that we see them as a source of our oppression, and that they're occupiers. They don't perceive themselves as occupiers. They could perceive themselves as on the side of justice, that they are victims who then destroy the lives of Palestinians, including ourselves, for doing nothing, just being in our car and being singled out because of how we look or the way in which we pray and worship.
Mm-hmm. Now, how would you answer this? Have you, with your students, your professor, the university, you probably have some Jewish students, some people now, they fall for the programming saying that, okay, and how do you address this? That, okay, there, you guys want to eliminate Jews, you hate Jews, you're anti-Semitic, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what do you say to that?
So I'm actually a human rights professor who starts almost all my human rights courses depicting images and stories of the Holocaust. Human rights history can be recounted as beginning with the Holocaust, in which millions of people were killed for no reason but for their religious belief. And that human rights stands for the principle that the sovereignty of a nation should never extend to killing people for no reason as what took place in the Holocaust. And it's because of my Jewish mentors when I grew up who motivated me to go into human rights. They are the same people who cheer me when I speak out against the occupation. I teach global Islamophobia, and in that course we have Jewish Americans. And we speak about the injustice of the Holocaust and injustices such as anti-Semitism as no different as injustices of Islamophobia encountered here in America, as well as in Palestine. And I bring to our class really fascinating global Islamophobia, a Holocaust survivor. She just recently passed away. Her name was Dora, 96 years of age. She passed away. She would come. She has repeatedly been part of the instruction of the course. And even though she was experiencing many disabilities, she came to our course basically a semester before she passed away, despite all the hardship, to speak out. And these are people who are supportive of us and who come to press conferences speaking out against genocide. And so we believe that the work we're doing is also spreading the message that anti-Semitism is wrong. But then if anti-Semitism is wrong, it's no different than the mass Islamophobia that we see in this land of occupation. Why should a people like the Palestinians have their land revoked from them and have not the possibility of their dreams constantly being taken away and ripped away from their lives because they're subject to arrest and attack and being singled out at checkpoints? That isn't the life that people, including Jewish Americans, have fought for in the civil rights movement and in fighting against the Holocaust.
Well, this is an important point. So you had Jewish mentors who helped motivate you to get into human rights and who are now praising you for speaking out. They're Jews also who are praising you for the work you're doing, speaking out against the injustices, what's happening on the ground in Jerusalem, in Palestine.
Absolutely. My doctoral supervisor when I did my PhD, Jewish American, and I have mentors at the university where I taught, Jewish Americans. And as I grew up, I was taught by creative educators with a Jewish background who are constantly being supportive, as you mentioned, speaking out against this occupation. In fact, my doctoral supervisor has suggested that the very existence of the state and how it's organized is completely unjust. So this was before
she's
the Gaza.
She's Jewish also.
She's Jewish.
Oh.
And this was before the attacks in Gaza against Palestinians. And so people who look at human rights and the history of human rights, it's undeniable when you look at events on the ground.
Yeah, you have all the human rights organizations also. It's across the board, isn't it?
Absolutely.
They're calling this a apartheid state, illegal occupation.
Absolutely. And people who have been conducting scholarship like Norman Finkelstein and Noam Chomsky, who are very familiar about the laws and what has been happening on the ground for decades, there's no question in their mind that the reason why these attacks continue is because of a media charade that this is just a democratic state, innocent, victimless. It is doing no wrong. In fact, it's committing some of the most heinous human rights violations on the planet and one of the last nations to persist in its colonialism, mm-hmm. as most of the countries of the world have effectively enabled their colonized nations to declare independence.
Yeah.
How about Palestine?
Before we get more into the dungeon, descriptions of the dungeon and what happened in the dungeon with both of you, just tell me, this is very interesting. Most people don't know this because they've uncovered that many of these politicians over there, they're not even Semitic. You're actually Semitic. You guys are both Semitic. I mean, Palestinians are Semitic.
Absolutely.
So they're being anti-Semitic coming from Europe. They have last names, Golski, Joski, Polish names. They're European, actually.
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
Is this true? They're hiding under this Semitic now label, but they're not even Semitic. The majority who are coming and stealing the land, they're European.
Yeah, many of them have come from Europe.
You guys are Semitic.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Yes, yeah. And that's absolutely true. Many people have come and they migrated to Palestine. Open arms Palestinians welcome them. And
welcomed
them because they were fleeing persecution. Jews have been pursued and attacked throughout Europe for centuries. And so they found refuge in Palestine, only for Palestinians to be met by betrayal. And so that is truly disturbing. And the real point is, cannot folks who already live there have a home that they can feel secure, that forces are not just showing up one day in front of them, taking their 13-year-old child, and to no end not knowing what is happening to them. They're being tortured, they're being attacked. Many, many, many worries and uncertainties just living in Palestine.
All right, so tell us now what happens. Okay, so Canadian citizen, American citizen, you go down there, human professor of human rights, you get down there, you're there for some time, and all of a sudden you end up in a dungeon.
Absolutely.
In a prison. How and what happened then?
Yeah, so I was heading towards the Al-Aqsa Masjid, the primary site of my research, on December 1st, and there was a call by Israeli forces, the government of Israel, to capture my research assistant and myself. As I was walking and heading towards Al-Aqsa Masjid, one of the officers, because every gate of Al-Aqsa has Israeli forces, one of the officers at one of the gates immediately spotted me coming down, walked, rushed towards me, and was scrolling through his phone. I could see my picture, and then began a chapter unimaginable of research, an ethnography from hell. Effectively, I was handcuffed on my hands and on my feet. The cuff sort of coiling into my skin, my nerves burning. I was stripped naked, paraded through the old city, thrown into a van, blindfolded when I arrived and processed.
Where they stripped you down in public?
Yeah, well, in front of the officers.
Yeah.
They took me to a location that all various officers were, and all of them were looking at me. They've asked me to strip completely. And then they walked me, they paraded me through the old city, threw me into a van. As they were putting pressure on the handcuffs, sort of applying a lot of pain on my nerves, and then took me to the infamous Meskoubeya prison, which is a prison where many Palestinians have been taken, where they have different levels of interrogation. They took me to the highest level of security in the basement of Al-Meskoubeya, and there, windowless, solitary confinement in a hole, imprisoned, you know, two huge metallic doors to keep me in, we began our journey. I was alone in the beginning. We sometimes overlapped. And for 12 days, we also engaged in a hunger strike. And Brother Khalid could also talk about being sent to Askalan in order for them to learn more about why we were in Palestine and who were we.
So yeah, they sent me to a fake prison, like a theater, where everyone is acting as if he is a Palestinian. And you know, you feel like you are in, like, at home within your family members. Everyone is acting nice. Everyone is acting like he loves you and he likes you and brings food to you and brings a lot of things to you. And, like, I felt very, like, I had, like, intimate relationships with all of them. And they were trying to trick me to say about Dr. Hassan. So at one point he said, Sheikh Khalid, they were calling me a Sheikh Khalid in the prison, just, you know, to give me, like, even an extra step to feel more comfortable, like they are giving me here. Say, Sheikh Khalid, can you give us kind of a lecture about what are the ideas, strategic ideas of Dr. Hassan for liberating Palestine? We want to learn more and we really love the ideas. And said, yes, why not? So, and they used also to push me to lead the prayer, and sometimes they used to bring me food to the place where I was, like, and it was like, it was a traumatizing experience, actually. Like, I was so naive. Like,
how did you find out this was a fake? This is
after like 3-4 days of faking everything around me. They took me back to the Meskoubeya prison in Jerusalem. That was in Askalan. Askalan is near Gaza. He took me back and he told me explicitly, you were in an intelligence, like you are in a fake prison. And
I told you.
Yeah, they told me that the person who was talking to me is an intelligence officer. So basically I was talking to an intelligence officer. And I can't tell you how traumatizing the experience was. Mm-hmm. I can't really emphasize.
So what happens day to day when you guys are there? How you end up doing a hunger strike? Are you beaten? Are you, you're already talking about, you know, the pain is starting to begin. Did it intensify? What was the day to day?
Yeah, the day to day was a constant interrogation, sleep deprivation, being handcuffed to a chair in a vulnerable position with threats, like up to 7 people coming, you know, at one time questioning you, shouting attacks, threatening that I'm going to stay and live, you know, in prison for the rest of my life, that they have that capacity, that the our governments didn't care about us. They know that we're here and they just have no interest in learning more about us. A lot of innuendo that they might engage in even further attacks. What we understand is a lot of the youth that we were working with were also imprisoned. Like they would point out, you know, through the wall, this, you know, Brother Imran is here, Sheikh Sami is here. And we learned that a lot of the youth were beaten. And so they're willing to do that. They also put us in brown clothing, which is meant to be emblematic of being in prison, which was kind of peculiar. They stripped our clothing and my thawb and put on this brown clothing that implies that you are actually a resistance fighter. And so they had designated color, you know, for clothing. Orange was if you were there because you violated the law. Brown was if you were a resistance fighter against the occupation. And so we're dressed in this brown clothing, being sent, and they played pretend justice with us. So we would take into a judge. At first, it was like high security, sort of handcuffed on my feet, sent in a single van, waiting, put, you know, my face against the wall until I could speak to the judge for a few seconds, and then scurried back to prison. And then later, we were all sent to the van with other prisoners, and I would start delivering speeches to the judge, telling him, how could this persist? That this being in this very court is a violation of human rights, and that many Jewish Americans that I knew, and I would say that because I was raised on the Holocaust, I pointed out, would find this deplorable. And people in the court would just stare, to the point where, for some odd reason, at the very end, even though it wasn't necessary, the judge brought me, after the decision was made for my deportation, and I was told by that we were now going to head back, which, by the way, was itself a whole story of how the process of us heading back. But the judge made a point of bringing me before and saying, okay, now I have authorized your deportation. It seemed that his conscience was somehow impacted by the speeches, and he wanted me to say that what happened was just. One of the things, by the way, that I feel a lot of folks don't realize is that, you know, many people ask, you know, Dr. Hassan, how could you speak out? It's kind of stupid. Like, you called for liberation. And then the question that we ask today is, and the real question is, how can you not? If no one speaks, then no one will know. And even Jews living in Palestine, they themselves don't know the extent of the suffering and the torture. And so we have great opportunities to speak out. Our tradition starts off with stories of only basically the message is to speak. And so from the words of that we know being dragged through the streets of the scorching heat of Mecca, that we heard, and all the people in Mecca heard the words, right, of Bilal, the Ahadun Ahad, Ahadun Ahad, Ahadun Ahad. All that the Prophet ﷺ and the Sahaba, the companions, may Allah be pleased with them, did was to speak a word of truth. And that's why we were there, to speak the truth.
Absolutely.
With no regard to consequence. Absolutely. Because if someone, a Muslim, sees these acts and doesn't speak out, then who will? And despite all of the worries and fears that the youth counseled us about, and despite all that people say that how ridiculous it is for people to call for the liberation openly, here we are in front of you, dear brother, speaking the truth, because Allah sent us back. And this was one of the extraordinary things, that while we were going through the prison system, we met one of the people who we knew well in Al-Aqsa, Brother Faris. He asked me a question. He said, what would you do if you go back to America? And I said, we would speak out.
Absolutely. Who asked you that?
One of the youth that we worked with that was also being imprisoned with us. We met him while you're being processed to appear before the court. These mock trials. We would be caged with other Palestinians. And he looked at me and said, what would you do in Arabic if you went back to America? And I said, we would speak out. And one of the most extraordinary things appeared in his response. He had this huge smile. In the midst of his torture, what gave him pleasure was the fact that I would be here with you right now on the Dean Show, speaking out and telling the world our experience and the injustices that they suffer, because they believe very few know about the fact that people are shouting now in the occupation that is underground, in the jails that proliferate Palestine.
Tell me this. So you mentioned that the people who are even there, who are like 20 minutes away from all of this oppression, are you saying that most of them, they don't know really to what extent their neighbors are being oppressed?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. And that was
I've heard some Israelis also who speak out against this. They also say a lot of information is kept from them, and they're over here, you know, whining and dining and just having a great time. And they're just programmed like these people, they just want to eradicate us.
Exactly.
Yeah?
Absolutely. And the government is structured and the society is structured by containing the information and having a segregated realm for Jews and a segregated realm for Palestinians. Mm-hmm. The occupation thrives on segregation. And that's what one of the reasons why we wanted to deliver protests that were peaceful, to let Jews living in the land be aware by sharing our stories together of the oppression and suffering that we are facing in Palestine. So it was not just only for the world or for Americans or for Europe, it's for people who live in Jerusalem, who don't know and who think of the Palestinian as one step away from eradicating them. Exactly as you, by the way, described. Mm-hmm. And through fear of Palestinians, that segregation is maintained.
One second, I'm trying to find some I wanted to show you.
Mickey, you can call it the Palestinian phobia instead of Islamophobia.
Absolutely. Palestinophobia, and that's a true experience that every day people are suffering. The reality of these attacks on Palestinians includes the attack of silence. The fact that they can't speak, they can't declare the injustices that they suffer because the authorities keep stifling their opportunities to share to the world or to other Jews the experiences that they endure every day.
Yes.
So that's a reality. And so the occupation is not just about the overt things that authorities commit on a daily basis. It's also of the covert silence
yes.
that they engage in. So yeah, absolutely, Eddie, that's a huge part of the reality of the occupation. And the prisons are one of the most extraordinary technologies to enable the persistence of the silence, because no one knows of the shouting, of the torture, of the attacks behind the bars of the jails in the underground.
Mm-hmm.
And so this silence is a real part of the occupation. One story that I think many might want to hear is that many of these youth are presented with a life of uncertainty. People go through these cycles. At the time they turn 13, the Israeli forces come to their door. And it's preemptive, like they don't do anything. They're just trying to train Palestinians to recognize that you could be imprisoned anytime. And they grab Palestinians sometimes randomly at different times. And so someone might be getting married, someone might just have a child, and then suddenly they find themselves in prison and they don't know when they're going to be released. And so this is a measure of the occupation, making sure that no one speaks out, that there's no opportunities for Palestinians to share their story, is a vital part. And it's truly part of the wisdom of the Prophet ﷺ to speak out.
So these are kids, before we conclude now, so these are kids
yes.
that are taken at such a young age,
yes.
thrown in jail,
yes.
in the dungeon also like you were, and they just don't know, their parents have no rights or way to get them out?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it becomes just part of life. Like you begin to try to find ways, but it's unknowable, to prevent yourself from getting imprisoned. But also you have the pressure that you have to make ends meet. You have to go out and work. You have to go into a car.
To school as well.
Mm. Yeah, and people still, that's one of the most indomitable features of the Palestinian people. They still have all these dreams, but the dreams themselves are part of the brutality of the occupation,
mm-hmm.
because you get the dream to go to school and to graduate and to get married, but then you're arrested or you can't pursue them.
Before we conclude, you have an organization that details more of some of your work and can learn more about what's happening there?
Absolutely. I'm one of the co-founders of the Abandon Biden movement. We have an organization called the Civil Rights Alliance for America. It's dedicated to use the political system to advance the priorities and interests of the Ummah. In particular, for now, we're focusing on the issue in Palestine, and we're asking people to abandon the president, a genocider, who's enabling these attacks in Gaza to persist. The case we make is that if we punish the president, and then we're the ones who are seen as the reason at our own hands, Muslim Americans who have the power to do that in the swing states, then we would end up buying power. Because right now the problem, if you diagnose it, is that no one is taking us seriously, even though we are speaking out and coming out in protests. And so we must punish politicians, almost all of them right now, who are not advancing the interests of Palestinians, despite the clear images of suffering and injustice that's taking place. And so we are making the case that Muslim Americans might be the most powerful Muslims on the planet, and yet they don't know it. And all they have to do is vote. Vote against genocide and vote for truth. And through telling the truth, they would follow in the footsteps of the Prophet ﷺ, who asked us to say the truth, even if it harms us. That's our goal.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, guys, for sharing this with us. Hopefully, people who are trying to understand the situation a little better, this sheds some more light on it. And whoever's humanity is on, they can go ahead and speak out. Speak out.
Inshallah. And jazakallah khair, dear brother, for always speaking out. And for all the Muslims all around the world, we ask you to speak out and to ask those who we live with for the prevailing of truth and justice to come, not only to Muslims, but all non-Muslims on this planet that suffers, and at a time which our Ummah is weak and so much in dire need of a victory. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant us this victory.
Ameen. Thank you. Ameen. And if you'd like to learn more, we opened up and we talked about a little bit of the history, and there's a lot of programming condition. The hate industry is a $1 billion industry. And if you'd like to learn for yourself, pick up the phone, call us 1-800-662-ISLAM, ask your questions. If you'd like to read this book, the Quran, I'll get it to you for free, and see for yourself what Islam is about, what Muslims are about. See for yourself. Go to thedeanshow.com. We'll get it to you for free. Until next time, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.